Okay, December 9th, Tuesday, 2025. Welcome all. Yes, these, well, anybody who's listening to this knows that it's either on, they're either on YouTube or they're on my podcast, but I was going to mention that the discovered that the guided meditations that I recorded from my book, Sought Through Meditation, which I published last year, some people were having trouble playing them on my website, and so they're going to be, we're going to put them into the podcast feed too, so you can just listen to guided meditations through a podcast. And when I say podcast, it makes it sound like it's, you know, one of those things where, you know, you have conversations and maybe a few ads here and there, you know. It is not any of that. It is just a recording of this. And that was just a simple way to make it accessible for people who want to listen to these. But since all you guys are here, there's no reason you would be listening to this later unless I say something so brilliant that in, you just want to remember what. What was it that he said? I've got to. Anyway, yeah, never mind. We ordinarily start with a 20-minute sit, followed by some sort of a talk, which has been percolating in my brain. And we'll see if the percolation, you know, makes a nice cup of coffee or something less. Flavorful, we shall see. Or stimulating, perhaps I should say, if I'm going to make a joke about coffee, it should be about stimulation. What else did I want to say? Oh, for those in the Bay Area, I am teaching tonight at the Berkeley Buddhist Monastery, my monthly second Tuesday class at the monastery. And, nice place to be in person. Oh, one other thing for people in the Bay Area who are very serious. I'm going to be speaker or something, whatever it is. I will be at the Recovery Dharma meeting at 924 Gilman this Sunday morning at 10 o'clock. And for those who don't know 924 Gilman, it's a legendary punk rock club out of which came groups such as Operation Ivy and Green Day and maybe Rancid and some of the other delightful punk bands of the Bay Area, of which I'm very proud, but I would never, well, I do listen to Green Day, but the rest not so much. You know, I'm more of a like a mellow person, you know, except when I need like, you know, AC/DC or something else old. Okay, sorry. It takes me a little while to get warmed up on these mornings, okay? Just stick with it. We'll get there. You know how it is. Those who have been here before know that there's a warm-up period. Have to have you go out and shoot a few baskets, you know, take a few free throws, and then we're ready to jump ball. Okay. So we'll have our jump ball now. And that don't get me started talking about basketball. Okay, I won't. Okay. So settling back into your meditation posture, which by now you've probably been in for a while, just waiting, right? And whatever that is, whether it's sitting up or lying down, standing, walking, you can close your eyes or just lower your gaze. And just turning the attention inward. I like to start meditation not so much by trying to concentrate right away, but by just checking in with myself. And for you, obviously, checking in with yourself. How are you feeling? You might not want to think about how you're feeling if you're not feeling great. But that's what you have. It's what's here. And being with it without running away or figuring it out or processing it in some way, just feeling. It's a vital part of mindfulness. We'd all like to use our meditation to feel better, and that certainly is often one of the results of our practice. But it's important to start with the recognition of how things are right now in your body, in your emotional world, in your mind, in your environment. So in a sense, just accepting how things are right now before starting to direct the mind, work with the body. This is how it is right now. And then seeing if you can let the body settle a bit, having a sense of relaxing, releasing, softening the belly, letting the shoulders relax. Loosening the jaw is a place we often hold tension in the face. And just an overall sense of feeling that you're being drawn to the earth, just a sense of letting go through the body. And then letting the attention come to the breath. Just feeling the body breathing, the movement of the body, the sensations, touch of air. And the initial insight of mindfulness meditation is that we are thinking. Sometimes those thoughts take the form of talking to ourselves. Other times they're more discursive. But it's this realization that our attention is so unstable, so easily drawn into the wandering mind, that is so striking, so challenging. What to do with that? Well, the simple instruction is to notice when the mind has wandered and gently come back to the breath. Sometimes that noticing alone will have the tendency to interrupt the thought and have it just drop away. Other times, with more insistent thoughts, they'll continue on even when we are intentionally trying to move the attention to the breath or away from the thought. We start to feel the power of thoughts, the pull of thoughts. We are trying to train the mind, train the attention, first of all, to rest in the present moment, using the breath as a connection to the present moment. However, our meditation, if we only work on this level, can become a kind of ping pong between thinking and pulling it back to the breath, and then mind drifting again, thinking and coming back to the breath, so that our practice stays above the neck. And here's where a broader awareness of the body and the feeling world, the inner feeling world, becomes important. We start to see that thoughts and breath are not the whole of our experience. That there is another sense realm connected to the body, connected to emotions, to subtle feelings. And this, with these areas of experience, are not disconnected from the thought world or the breath world. So it can help to expand the awareness into the whole body, into the feeling world. And in a sense, watch this interaction, this flow of experience. Thought of breath, body of feeling. See that there is a kind of rolling wave of interaction. And that we can train our awareness to, in a sense, step back and watch this. Not grasping at any aspect of experience, not pushing away any aspect. Keeping a broad sense of openness, of acceptance, of curiosity. This flow of experience. Well, I often either get an idea for a Dharma talk through the guided meditation, or I guide the meditation based on my idea for a Dharma talk. So today it's the second because I'd been thinking about thinking, as we do, as Buddhists do. And I mentioned before, I've been doing some writing around depression, which is not a thing I recommend anyone attempt to do because it's depressing to write about depression. And so, unless you're not susceptible to those moods, it's... nonetheless, here I am. And it happens that, just for like the inside baseball of Kevin's life, I've put in a book proposal which an editor likes, and he's taking it to the editorial board of his publishing company. And so, I get to wait to be judged. And of course, my self-esteem is all on the line here. God knows. But, screw publishers. Anyway, God bless everybody, including publishers. All right, so the topic, thinking about thinking. So this is what I was thinking about thinking as I'm writing about depression, is how a lot of like the therapeutic work around depression is focused on thoughts. And there can be this sense, and I've had cognitive behavioral therapy, and it's like the idea of like, oh, look at your thoughts and see what they're saying, and see if they're, and how that is not really accurate. That the what they call cognitive distortions. One of my favorite terms, like cognitive distortions. Most of my cognition is distorted, so. So cognitive distortions, and to realize and to like step back and think about that thought, right? Which is so weird that humans, we really have these odd capacities. I wonder if AI can think about its thinking anyway. We'll have to ask AI. Okay, sorry, this is gonna be a long morning, folks, before we'll see where we get to. And so with cognitive distortions, you're able to see, oh, like that's not really accurate. I'm not really an idiot, because how would I have a master's degree if I'm an idiot? That sort of, logic, applying logic, or yeah, I guess I would consider it logic to the thoughts that are passing through our mind. I think, a really skillful practice. Aaron Beck was a psychiatrist, and I think from in Philadelphia, I think he was from, anyway, who came up with this strategy. It was very different from, psychoanalysis and all that. But and it's valuable, and it also sort of ignores your body, and it sort of ignores the feeling realm. And as I was saying in the meditation, when we focus entirely on, oh, I'm thinking, let me come back to the breath. Oh, I'm thinking again, let me come back to the breath. It becomes this ping pong, just back and forth but it's like all happening up here, right? Because the breath, if you're paying attention to the breath, at your nostrils especially, it physically is staying up there. And then it seems like mentally, since we seem to have this sense that thoughts are happening up here. I suppose not everybody has that feeling, but it's the one that I have and I hear from people. Then it does. It kind of disconnect you from your body, which misses, a whole realm of experience. And, again, I've been talking about this a lot, the nervous system. It's like, when we think about our mind, or even our brain, or even our thoughts, we think about it all like happening in this in this brain, you know, and not recognizing that the whole nervous system is part of the mind, right? I mean, I'm not like a scientist, you know, but the more I think about this stuff, the more I sense like it's not like there's just this mind and body thing. The nervous system is part of the mind. And in a lot of ways, awareness of what's going on in the nervous system, I think, gives us more insight. That is to say, direct understanding, direct experience of the mind. That's in a way, it's assisted by not having words, because words are an intermediary between experience and reality. And wait, what am I saying? No, between experience, I guess, and understanding. In any case, let me see if I talk myself into a corner there. You know, words are an attempt to capture what is happening, right? It's to make sense of what is happening in reality, you know, which is already a tricky little concept. I've just been reading Ajahn Amaro talking about how our perception of reality, of the world through our senses, is all in the mind. So, and again, it comes back to what's the mind, you know. But just to be clear about that, what I mean is that a sense experience, there's a, let's say that we see something, the light is received by the eye, which transmits an interpretation of what it's seeing, or a version of it, into the brain, which like makes sense of it. So when we make sense in the brain, it's the secondary experience. It's not the direct knowing of the thing. So the coming back to thought is this whole other, like, we have an experience and then we're turning it into this fabrication. Language is this fabrication, which is attempting to replicate, say, well, there's reality here, which is already a problem for us to actually understand. And then I'm going to represent it with sounds and this thing we call language. And so there, I guess what I'm getting at is that our thoughts are not an accurate representation of reality, and they don't capture that much of our experience. And so if I'm talking about depression, where does depression happen? Is kind of the one way of approaching this question. What is depression, right? So the cognitive behavioral thing is like, well, depression is in your mind, it's in your thoughts. If you can change your thoughts, you won't be depressed. That's a oversimplification. That's not really what they're saying, but it's, you know, that's kind of the what they're getting at. If we can change these thoughts, and what depressed person hasn't had people say, oh, just think more positively, you know? You know, if you're one of those people who's been faced with people telling you that you're negative in the way you think, you know, it's like that's not helpful. So it's not a matter of just changing your thoughts, is the point. I guess that's the point in what I'm talking about. That rather we have to go into the whole body, feel the whole experience. And as you know, this point that I keep coming back to, and which is sort of the essence of what I want to write about, which is that if we can stay at this felt level, at this visceral level of experience, we can interrupt the arising of the thoughts. So we don't even have to go there in a sense, that we can stay on this felt level. Because my sense of what happens with depression is that there is initially a feeling which gets then cognized and turned into a thought, an interpretation of what's happening, and then starts to get caught in this analytical feedback loop struggle, this trying to make your mind behave the way you want it to behave. Meanwhile, ignoring the fact that there's this feeling that's just feeding into that thinking. And that when you stay on this feeling level, it's a nonverbal level, it's a preverbal level. And that right there, it's that the reason it turns into this mental experience is that there is aversion to the unpleasant felt experience. And because of the aversion to the unpleasant felt experience, the mind tries to step in and control the experience and fix the experience. And the mind can't do that. And so it gets stuck in this rut that eventually becomes this unwholesome state and can become overwhelming. And so one of the vital things we learn to do with mindfulness is to be with the unpleasant without allowing aversion to arise. This is called guarding the senses. And guarding really means guard, in this case, guarding the mind sense, guarding the felt sense to, and it's, I don't think we talk about this a whole lot as being one of the critical tools of mindfulness meditation. But what it is that we are asked to, when something arises, not do anything with it. And it could be a thought. It could be a sound. It could be, a sight. It could be a sensation in the body. Lots of times we're meditating, and if you're, meditating on a long retreat, the body starts to go through discomfort. And we're taught and we're trying to train ourselves to just sit with and allow that. And sitting with physical discomfort in meditation is one of the really valuable trainings for learning to sit with, I'll call it emotional discomfort, but it's not quite fully formed emotion, but to sit with emotional discomfort without reacting. And it's that reactivity that causes suffering. That's exactly what the Buddha is talking about when he talks about the two darts. The first dart is the inevitable pain of existence, and the second dart is the reactivity to that, which reinforces and doubles, or in a sense, squares, the initial pain. So the Buddha is saying, learn to sit with that initial pain. It's okay. You can do that. And if you do that, you will undercut the tendency for this to become doubled up or squared. So this is one of the key elements of mindfulness meditation. And when we are focusing mainly on thinking, we're in a sense, another layer away from this experience. And so we're missing it. So we wind up constantly on this kind of treadmill of like thinking, oh, thinking, that's the problem. I have to deal. Oh, there's another thought. Catch another thought. Catch, stop that thought. Let's come back to the breath. And it's like, no, that's you're t it's too late. You're too late when you're trying to solve the thought, when you're trying to let go of the thought. I mean, okay, sometimes it works. I'm not saying, there are times when it's just like, oh, it's just a doing the dishes thought. It's just a nothing thought. Okay, and then I come back and I'm fine. But if it's a thought that's got any juice, and I mean juice in the electrical sense, it needs to be felt, and this is, and for addicts, this is, a key quintessential problem of for addicts is feeling. is being okay with feeling, is not running from feeling, allowing ourselves to feel and learning to feel. That's the first thing. And it's why people relapse in their early recovery, because all of a sudden they're feeling stuff. And so mindfulness and recovery, go hand in hand here. If we can have this tool of mindfulness, particularly in early recovery, it can help us to learn to be with the discomfort of being a human. And particularly if you're an addict or have some kind of, tendency toward difficult feelings, learning to be with difficult feelings is, the survival skill, the necessary survival skill. And so we have this simple practice of breathing. And it turns out that the breathing with a feeling is kind of the ideal practice for it. Feeling tends to, the aversion to feeling tends to tighten the body, tends to tighten the breath, tends to enclose that energy. And when we breathe, when we learn to use the breath in an expansive way, we see that the in-breath opens the body and it works against that constrictive experience of difficult feelings. It opens the body, and then we learn to work with the exhalation, which is releasing and softening. Or that softening again counters the tightening. So the opening, softening, opening, releasing. This is how the breath works on this energetic level. It's not just a tool for concentration, which is again how it's taught. And I'd say taught in a very limited and, just a very limited way. Oh, use the breath as a concentration object to come back to the breath. No, the breath has much more of a function than just a concentration object. It has this function as a energetic balancing tool and an energetic releasing tool. So it's the place that I'm pointing to in my teaching. It's the point place that I'm pointing myself to a great deal of the time. And this has been in a couple of my books. It'll go into this new one if this ever becomes a book, if I don't, fall off the planet before that happens. Of this early in my practice, and many of you have heard this story and read it, but I'm sitting this retreat, this 3 month retreat, when I'm not even sober, and I'm like, I'm gonna get enlightened. I'm gonna go meditate my ass off. And it's like 2 weeks into the retreat, and it's the morning sit where Joseph Goldstein gives the meditation instruction, and I'm sitting, and I'm like, I'm kind of settled, but it's kind of blah. And it's strange to have these little moments in our lives that we remember. And a lot of my encounters with teachers that I remember are these just brief moments. So I walk up to the dais at IMS as he's turning away, getting ready to go off and do his interviews. And I go up and I say, Joseph, I'm settling in. It feels like I'm settling in. But there's still this kind of dullness. And he turns to me and says, "Don't be afraid to feel," and walks away. I'm like, what the hell? What do you mean? How did you get that from me saying this, right? And now that I've been around the block since then, I understand that, first of all, this is not the first meditator he's run into who's had this problem. And I'm easier to read than I think I am, right? And then, shortly within days after that, I'm in an interview with Jack Kornfield, and whatever I'm talking about my practice, he says, "Your practice is to feel." And at that point, I'm like, okay, I'm getting the message. I don't know what it is. I know what it is verbally. I know what the words are, but I don't know what they're really talking about. And that's 45 years ago, And it's still not just my practice, but my investigation and the question I continue to ask. I don't, I'm not even asking the question, what did they mean anymore? I mean, sort of, or were they talking about me? I used to think that it was very unlikely that they would have talked about me because there were all these different students on that retreat. But now, having been a retreat teacher, I realize that actually retreat teachers talk about the students all the time, and especially if there's some goofball stoner who might stand out. Like that one guy, him, Griffin. Yeah, he really needs, you got to help him. Yeah, I know. So anyway, your practice is to feel, carried me for all these years and continues to. And I do think, I mean, for me, I've come to understand that that means my practice is not to stop thinking or to get concentrated, that's not going to solve the conundrum of my existence, of, yeah, whatever, solve the problem, however you characterize it. I'm going to solve the dukkha, that I need to first and foremost feel, and out of everything else comes out of that, and everything else does come out of that. The insight into impermanence, into suffering, into not self, all comes out of that. Yeah. And love, compassion, sympathetic joy, equanimity, all come out of that, out of just being present with feeling. So it's not like, oh, I'll do this and that'll, then I'll get back to Dharma or something. It's really a gateway into the whole of the Dharma. So I've managed to calm myself down. I hope I've calmed you down. I'll open it up for any thoughts or comments or questions. Thank you. I don't track all the people in here, but just well, I see a couple hands up now, so I was just going to say, I welcome people who haven't been here before to ask questions, but please, Holly, go ahead.
Hi.
Hi.
There's a, it's interesting how much this talk has plugged into some of the things I've been doing. I've been reading The Wakeful Body by Willa Blythe Baker with a Buddhist group, which it's just all about what you're talking about. And also, I've been going through your workbook with my sister for the last year, just little bits at a time. And also, so much of that connects together, these two readings, the way you talk about being in your body, much more than your standard Buddhist talk kind of thing that I've been exposed to. And I was just thinking last night, we were reading this The Wakeful Body, and I was thinking, I was feeling a lot of resistance to it. Mm-hmm. And I figured out that it was my own aversion thinking about to wanting to be all in my head.
Yeah.
So I appreciate your work, and I love how it connects that way. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Holly. I was thinking during the meditation about I think, therefore I am, and how that is that's kind of the Western way of understanding who we are. We are our mind. We are our thoughts. And so when we think that we kind of can control the world through our thoughts, and so
thank you.
Hi, Flo.
Hi, Kevin and Sangha. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, indeed.
Okay, good. I just want to say that, especially hearing your description of depression, I've been battling it this entire year. And I haven't in a very long time since getting sober. So the way you expressed it, as far as through the thought aspect, was it like struck so close to home, because that's what I've been doing. I haven't realized that, but that's what I've been doing in my meditation, is trying to like self-fix and figure out
mm-hmm.
what I need to do.
Yeah.
How can I control it? I just need to, I think you even said something like, thinking of a plan or coming up with, I think it was more concentration, you said.
Yeah.
And I just keep thinking I need to try harder. I need to do more. And it's literally when you said it's like being on a treadmill. I'm like, that is how it has felt this entire year, So for someone who's working through it, and of course I've gone through cognitive behavioral therapy, I've done a ton of therapy over this past year. I'm still sober, so that's great.
Woo-hoo.
But but like, any suggestions on how you can work with that? I mean, you discussed on how to work with that within practice, but when you're in the midst of that,
yeah,
what would be the antidote?
Yeah. No, a good question. And first of all, I also want to acknowledge, and I think I can lose this, that sometimes there are really difficult things going on in our lives that trigger that naturally, you lose the job, you have the breakup, your parent dies or something, all kinds of things happen that are disturbing. And if, and it's not like I can just get away from all that, escape it all just by meditating it. But in terms of like what I do in real time is I do literally, like, when I catch it, which usually happens by hearing a thought, I go, wait, and I reverse engineer it. I go, wait, what am I feeling right now? And then I can do this in just a moment, like, and I kind of feel the breath, and I remind myself, and so I first of all just let myself feel it, like, ugh, and then the cognitive stuff I do is about, this is impermanent. Like, I actually remind myself, like, I'm probably going to feel better later. Like, my day is not one steady mood. There are high points and low points. And that this is just a feeling that's showing up right now. And that I need to just keep going, like keep functioning. Right. What's the next helpful thing I can do? Not how am I going to fix this, but what, do I need, I need, there's some work I need to do, or I haven't gotten any exercise today, or did I eat yet? Or, I think I'll call a friend. I have, I'm probably a little disconnected or lonely. So the initial thing is just like, let me be with the raw experience and accept it, not resist, not get into aversion with it. Can I just feel this? Because it's unpleasant, but it's not that bad. Ultimately, because there's agonizing pain, and most of the time the depressive states are just really crappy, but they're not agonizing, and so I can there so I can't accept them, and so I have to start with acceptance and then move into a wise response. So I'm not reacting or trying to fix. I'm saying, what, how can I care for myself right now? Which is a subtle difference, right? And we can easily slip into the fixing, controlling mode. But that's why the acceptance of it is so important to start with it. Because once there's acceptance, there isn't a need to fix it. Now it's just self-care, right? Now it's wise action. And it's the world of difference. And yet it's such a subtle shift. So, I mean, that's, it is the same thing as in practice, except in practice, I spend more time with the feeling. In practice, I stay with it and breathe with it and really try to almost process it energetically. Like breathe with it and let it move through my body and allow it with, as I stay with it for a while, actually concentration does develop. Because concentration arises when there isn't desire and aversion in the mind. And so if I'm just with the experience, even if it's unpleasant, it's, I can start to get concentrated, and actually the feeling itself can transmute into a different state. It's quite striking that you can, that unpleasant state can actually become pleasant by breathing and giving it space and letting it and just staying on the energetic level. So that's, but within the real time of a daily activities, it's just you do have to take a moment of mindfulness, of acceptance, of breath. And part of that, it can be one breath that I'm trying to energetically release and make space and release. And then, as I say, respond with care and with wisdom. And it doesn't always work, We do our best. Yeah. Thanks. Nice to see you. Okay, good. Some other hands. And I am not concerned about going over. And I know some of you, some people have already had to go. And I know some people will have to go and be well. But I'm going to hang out here a little longer. Kathleen, hello. I'm not hearing you. Did you were unmuted according to the screen, but maybe your microphone volume is turned down. Yeah, I don't know what that is. Can you write a question into the chat? Okay. All right, for now, I will wait for that to come and then and speak to Mary Helen in the meantime. Hello, dear.
Hi, Kevin.
Hi.
Thank you. So I've been sitting here thinking about how this translates into the realm of the neurotransmitters and the serotonin levels and those sorts of things. And I don't know quite enough about that, the biochemistry there, to come up with an ex you know with a more direct question. But my experience with depression really has included the need to take an antidepressant in order to get to the point where I can feel those ups and downs and then work with, as you're talking, work with the feelings, and all of that makes sense. But there was something about my just my biochemistry, I guess, that made that difficult for me to do without an antidepressant.
I'm no doubt. Like, I'm not trying to step in and replace psychiatry. I have taken antidepressants at times. I don't like them, and I guess I also I'm such an old school alcoholic, but there's part of me that's like, I don't really like taking drugs.
I know.
But there have come times. And there may come times again when the stuckness of it all seemed immovable, or at least I wasn't able to move it, and that's the only thing that helped me to break out of it. So no doubt, I w my frustration with antidepressants is mostly that I never any of the psychiatrists I worked with never. Like recommended that you stop. It seemed like, a perpetual thing, which I find frustrating because they market it literally as something temporary. And then they never tell you, okay, now I think you should wean yourself and let's help you get off. I shouldn't, I'm not, I can't speak for all of the psychiatric world, the people I've worked with. I didn't do that, and that annoyed me. So that I got myself off twice, successfully, in the sense that I didn't relapse into depression, but not with that, not with their help, not with their help. So, but yeah,
Thank you.
and thank you, Mary Helen. Really important, and I appreciate you bringing that up because I do want to remind people that I'm not suggesting that people shouldn't take, medication. I want to, Gail, I see you've got your hand up, and I'm reading your chat now. The chat is appearing differently now, and I realize I have to look at it differently. But if you want to unmute and say something, but it says, did she said in the chat, did feeling help you get recovery from your addiction? Did you get sober before you started feeling? And if so, did it make you want to use again? Whew. I don't know. It's kind of the answer. I mean, did feeling help you get? I'm sure I believe that my meditation practice, had to have been part of the movement to, that what I want that took me into sobriety, and since feeling was part of my meditation practice, but then yes, it was part of getting sober, but it wasn't very clear to me at the time. It wasn't like I was, oh, this. It was all kind of blurry. Things were just sort of happening. And my understanding of this didn't start to come together really until well after I got sober. Did it make me want to use again? So I think that I had a pretty easy early recovery, so I didn't have the typical thing that I was actually describing, which is like, oh, I'm sober now, I'm feeling things I don't want to feel. I didn't really go through that. I felt actually kind of happy when I got sober. I was like, oh, this is a lot better. So I don't know. And then Kathleen, and we got the chat from her. Is your practice to feel applicable to everyone? I don't like to make broad statements about what everybody should do. I would just say, first of all, feeling tone is the second of the four foundations of mindfulness. So obviously, it's the Buddha was teaching this. I phrase it and talk about it differently from the way the suttas talk about it, but it's certainly a core Buddhist thing is to feel. So I think it's to say it's applicable to everyone, maybe is okay to say that. I just, as I say, I try to avoid, making really broad statements that everybody should do something. But yeah, I think it's applicable to everyone. But again, I would say try it. If you work with it and see what happens. I mean, if we're not feeling fully in our lives, then obviously we're missing something out of life. So there's that. So I thank everyone for coming. I am going to be hanging out on this Zoom with Vicky. So I'm going to ask everyone to
Thank you, Kevin. Have a good day.
take care. Yeah. Hope to see you guys next week, if not sooner.
Thank you, Kevin.
Oh, Friday
Bye.
night. I didn't even mention that Friday night is Spirit Rock, but Monica, you did put that in. So thank you.
Thanks, Kevin.
All right, Mike. Ooh, you're going out for a bike ride, or you came back from a bike ride?